Okay. I think we've got through our first 1, 2, 3 major topics, and we come to our final hour and a quarter. Communicating effects. So, Alan.
Yeah, I'd like to do just two things in this last hour. Part of it's about communicating effects, and the other part's about planning. Because I want to raise the issue about when we do some of these things in the process, and about, because I think communication about planning itself may actually be the key to some of this. And just if I leap into that, for example, from what I've heard, you know, some of the need for regulators to do additional work is because they think perhaps we're not asking the right questions at the right times. And I wonder whether us communicating our plans more clearly at the beginning of the process and partway through the process would actually be more helpful, or helpless, because it helps identify where there are some needs that you might need to fill in, for example. So keeping in mind this is mainly about communication, I was asking perhaps if, Paul, if I could ask you, you know, with the SEC, when you're sitting there perhaps and you're receiving, or you know that as a regulator and a standard setter set some requirements, and you want to assess what the likely effect is and be comfortable that enough work has been done, what sorts of things would you like to see in terms of reports or know that it's actually available for you to have a look at?
And this is speaking more in the context of the commission's work. You know, I think we have a different relationship with the FASB and accounting standards, because we generally rely on the work that they do, and there's no specific legal requirement. But from the commission's standpoint, you know, one of the things we do is try to seek comments early, and so as part of the Dodd-Frank rulemakings and the Jobs Act rulemakings, one of the things we've done is set up comment boxes as the staff is developing even the concept releases or the agenda decisions to elicit feedback to make sure that the way we're thinking about the project is the right way. And that has helped us do a better job in terms of framing the issue and really trying to streamline our process so that when the staff is doing work, it's focused in the areas of the greatest concerns.
Okay, so the early work or early communication is to help help on the focus and planning for later, perhaps. So if I was to relate that to the work that we're doing, if we signaled early on or sought some feedback quite early about where the deepest analysis should be done, that might help us make sure we focus on that, and gives us also a bit of credibility in terms of that we have picked the right areas to focus on.
That's correct. Trying to draw a parallel to your process.
Yeah, great. Okay, so others around the table in terms of from different jurisdictions, or it's unfortunate we lost Australia in the break, but the for example, with UK, what do you think is expected by the regulators, and what do you think the FRC would expect to provide?
What we do provide and what we're expected to provide may be slightly different. So I'll start with what we do, which is our best. We try to keep our various regulated communities informed of what we're doing and what we're planning. We do a lot of consultation. We tell them what we're trying to achieve, etc., etc., etc. I'm sure every organisation represented around this table does that. What, by and large, we don't do is to establish a timetable for issues in which we're going to consult on. And I think one of the things that the FRC will look at as we go forward is to try and develop a longer-term plan. We have an annual planning cycle at the moment, but we're going to try and develop a three-year planning cycle and to explain to our regulated communities, our stakeholders, what we will be trying to do over the next 3 years. And in particular, those issues which might require them to provide significant input in terms of consultation, etc. Now, that's going to be very tricky. It might work, it might not work, but that's what we're going to try and do. I know the IASB is very good, actually, at publishing forward plans.
And I think good at publishing them, but not keeping
them. I said very good at publishing. I'm evidence-based, and I see lots of excellent plans, and I think we can copy that. The trouble is that the real world intervenes, obviously, in all these things.
It's our constituents. If we didn't have difficulties.
Absolutely. Well, I sympathise, Ian. I think we'd say the same. So I think there's no perfect solution to this. I think certainly the FRC and I think most regulators could be perhaps a little bit more open about their plans, about the issues in which they particularly want people to give views, and perhaps a little bit more upfront when there are delays and when issues prove more difficult than perhaps originally expected. But this is, you know, this is one of these processes that's going to go on forever. I'm sure, you know, the ancient Romans were worrying about consultations on this, that and the other. I'm sure that in our descendants in 1,000 years' time will be worrying about these things. All we can do is try and be as open, transparent and straightforward with people as possible. We can devise processes that try to deliver that. But I think we've found, certainly from our private survey work, about how people view us, that in general they respect the fact that we do consult and that we do look at the impact of what we do, but they also feel that we send out an awful lot of material and we don't always give enough thought to those constituencies, those market participants or whoever who have to deal with that. And that's a very honest, open response, to be honest. That's where we are and how we feel.
Other comments?
If I can ask a question then about...
This is Roman Wheel checking back in and checking out. I had to leave during the break, and I need to check out now.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for your contribution.
In touch later.
When we do our reports, and let's say that we've been, actually a common letter analysis would be a good example, we get comments from all over the world, and when we do the summary, we generally synthesize them by the nature or the type of presenter, whether it's a user or investor or preparer, auditor, for example. We will sometimes identify geographical differences if that's quite apparent from the analysis. Not a very exciting example, but joint arrangements. We know that Australia had already moved to get rid of proportional consolidation. They prohibited it anyway. So when our proposal was to move to equity method, they were already in place. So we observed or noted that. But we don't, for example, do... Sorry, there's somebody on the line who's not on mute. I've lost contact now. But we don't sit there, for example, and let's say we're doing some effects analysis, and we did quite a bit of the stuff in Europe. So we did, as one example, we did some stuff in the US, some in Australia, where we had workshops, round tables. We got some feedback from those things. We got some interviews with people. When we do the analysis, we would tend to put an aggregate analysis rather than continent by continent. How much of an issue is that for jurisdictions that then have to take our material? And I'm, you know, leading question something. For example, in Europe, you have to presumably look at the effect on the Eurozone as opposed to and European companies. If Paul was doing the same sort of assessment in the US, it's US investors whose interest he's protecting. So is the way we convey it important? In other words, country by country.
Quiet on. Yeah, Peter.
basically we are very interested in understanding whether Europe fits right in the middle of the pack on a particular issue, or whether European constituents are somewhere on the fringes on an issue. And even if Europe as a whole might be in the middle of the pack, but some countries are towards the end of a spectrum, that would also be relevant information in our particular case, because it does drive the rest of the process and how much information might be required subsequently.
Just challenge you on that. When you talk about Europe being here or there, or a country being here or there, it's a little bit simplistic, isn't it? Because generally there's not one opinion in Europe, or one opinion even in a country. It depends which side of the table you're sitting on, and all sorts of things. So you might know better than me whether we've witnessed whether really a region or a country really stands out as being separate. I mean, we do get some issues that it looks like that, but mostly we get a mixed message from most places.
Well, to comment on that, I think if you take something like IFRS 11 and proportion consolidation, that was a big issue in countries like France and Spain, but not in other countries.
Okay.
Just because of
history.
Previous gap for history, whatnot. And I think similarly, an issue like embedded derivatives comes up very strongly in France, also looking at the comment letters that you've received, not necessarily as much in other countries.
Okay.
There are national flavors.
Okay. Yes.
I would say that, this is an analysis you already do. You have information. So the more you can disclose about continents, or the better. And after that, I guess it's for us to go deeper if we want to put into a question. But the more you give, the better for the constituents. And it avoids a question and it increases transparency.
And you can dig if you need to, because all our letters are on the web. You know, I mean, if you want to do your own analysis of, in a particular way, you can do that if need be. Sue?
You've given a couple examples during the day about there being differences in the legal environment, tax environment of various countries around the world. So I don't know if part of what would be helpful is understanding why people have a different view, and to what extent it relates to those jurisdiction-specific issues, as opposed to something more general, like whether or not you think the information is relevant, whether you think it meets the conceptual framework. But certainly from a U.S. perspective, it would be helpful to know whether those reasons underlying it are also factors that are in play in the United States environment or not.
It's sometimes difficult. No, I think Peter gave a good example with proportional consolidation. It's because they've been doing it. And why would they want to change? It's perfectly satisfactory from their point of view. And so why are we suddenly banning it? And that's very often the reason for national attitudes, I think. It's just what they're used to. But there may be other reasons. I'm going to take your point that if we can see other reasons, we should point them out. Yeah.
I recognize you may not always know what they are, but to the extent that you do, it would be helpful to understand that, to be able to evaluate them properly.
Philippe?
I will concur with Peter that although the information you provide show that there are particular issues in France or Spain, it's always... It's important to see that why people will react in a certain sense in some countries and not in others. I think anyway, the more granularity you have in your effect analysis, the most interesting it is. And when you compare the effect analysis on IFRS 3, IFRS 11, and these, and you can see some improvement, because on IFRS 3 it was very, very general. It would not really, but you may have very general feelings, but you could not see in which country the impact would be the most important ones. On IFRS 11, it's much more interesting in that point of view. So I think it's something that should be continued, taking into account that, of course, it may not be agreeable for a country to be seen as the one who will have problems, but in any case, it can explain why we could have some concerns about the change. And but at the same time, something that we have always talk about that. But for example, on lease, it's very interesting the items which are developed, but we still lack the information about the sample of companies or entities which you have worked with, if there are different kind of issues by countries, things like that, and from which kind of techniques do you have collected the information or data, and so I understand that they had some outreaches, but also perhaps other kind of investigation. So I think this part is lacking, and then we would be very happy to have more information. How do you construct your analysis?
Yeah, that's a point. I think it's a point that Christelle made earlier this morning. I mean, I think the information's there on our website in various places, and you're always, when you're writing these things, trying not to be too lengthy, but yeah, I could take your point. There's a balance there. Yeah, it is.
Just to add also the proportionality for leases, it's a very significant project for at the moment, and it's one of them where it's going to have a lot of comments, and so yeah, proportionality doesn't need to be so extensive in every
Different depends.
Yes. Just echoing some of the thoughts, I think you have it in the agenda for communicating effects as discussion papers, exposure draft of standards. I think the timing is critical as to when do we actually communicate the effects, at the time of the discussion paper or at the time of the actual standard, you know, when the standard is actually evolved, because obviously discussion paper leads to exposure draft and then the standard. So it's an evolving process where you would gather the feedback on each of these and then maybe communicate the effects, basically communicate the cost to benefit analysis, or right at the beginning, right at the upfront. And secondly, just to add on, the especially on the lease accounting standard, I mean specific to the countries or the jurisdiction requirements, like for some jurisdictions, like getting the airline on or the aircraft on the books is more important for the user rather than like user believing like to get a photocopy machine on the balance sheet. I just wanted to draw on the timing of the communication.
Okay. If I can just respond to that, because I think it's a very good question about, it's not just about the timing, but also about the nature of, I think, of what we convey at each time. And to me, when we the way our programs now have been developing, when we produce a discussion paper as part of our research program, we're trying to actually see whether or not there is a financial reporting problem. And so, to me, the purpose of the discussion paper and the effects, in a sense, is we're trying to define there is a financial reporting problem. Here's what the effect is. It's a lack of information or some uncertainty about something, or there's high cost associated with complying. Arguably, we did that, I think, with agriculture, with IS 41, with bearer plants. People came to us and said, you know, they were concerned about the nature of the information for a particular class of agricultural product and the related costs in preparing that information as well. And so, in a sense, that was the justification for saying we should do something. So it's a very high-level effect, because you're just assessing and getting people to agree where there's a problem. And it comes back to, I think, your earlier point. You're then saying, is it worth doing anything, or should we simply do nothing because, well, there are potential alternatives, but they're all expensive, and just leave it the status quo. So that's what I think we would be conveying and asking at that point. We're asking people whether we should actually go and investigate further about getting a financial reporting solution. And if everybody agrees we do have a financial reporting problem, then we've got at least the green light to start to go ahead with it, and we've got a basis for starting to assess. When we get to an exposure draft, to my mind, that's the most critical, because at that stage, we're starting to say, well, we anticipate that on transition, we're going to do full retrospective accounting, because we believe that people, A, have the information, and C, it enhances comparability, relatively low cost to get the information, and so on. Now, if we're misinformed about that, then that's the time people should tell us. So I actually see our exposure draft process as being part of the effect, the evidence collecting process for effect analysis, because we're actually starting to set out what we think the likely effects are and asking for feedback on that. And so it is, and when we talk to our staff, that's a much sharper focus than it would be before, than at the discussion paper level. Then you get to the final one, then it's even sharper again, because we've said, look, on the basis of the information that we've actually got back, people have told us that, yes, we do have that information, or no, they didn't. So we change our proposals from the ED and decide that we'll have we'll account for it prospectively. We won't go back. There's too much hindsight judgment, or don't have the information. So we'll actually use that feedback to tell us this is what we're going to do. And to me, then if we're conveying that in terms of cost, we've actually got some evidence to support that. And so this goes back to my introduction. Perhaps at the same time that we do the exposure draft, we should be setting out our plans for what other types of analysis we're going to do to supplement the comment letters. But knowing that, sometimes it's better to wait actually until you've got your comment letters in, because two things. One is you know who you have heard from and who you haven't. And secondly, it's helped identify some issues that you might want to do some follow-up with, some in-depth analysis, some questionnaires, or some other type of work. So it's a continuous process, but to me it goes from general broad concepts to much sharper as we go down through the scale.
Just on the first step, the research, where we decide whether there's a problem or not, we may decide there is a problem and still not decide to do anything about it. And it could be that it's not high priority compared to other problems. It could be, as in our last agenda consultation, that our constituents have told us they've had enough change for a while and they want a bit of a rest. And the one that comes to mind is government grants, which is a very old standard, which my personal opinion has the wrong answer. And it's been on the agenda for years and never been taken up, because it's never been considered high enough priority in terms of the difficulties it's creating. There's lots of judgments that you make on the way through, and I guess they should all be explained. I mean, I suppose you should do an effects analysis if you don't take up a project as much as if you do, because you should be explaining why you haven't.
Yeah. Some of the things that we are thinking of doing and using technology to help us. Whenever we get comment letters in, we actually categorise them by nature of the writer, whether they're an investor, preparer, auditor, so on. We also identify what region they're writing from, and we do communicate with them to make sure we classify them properly. And we capture that internally in our system, but we don't convey that necessarily externally. So we've been talking with our IT guys about doing a system that, as we capture that, you could, as an interested party, for example, just say, I want to see the comment letters from investors. You click investors, it will just show you that defined list. And we do that geographically as well. I'm trying to think of ways that we can convey information by region or by that type of author without us having to write special reports, and that this is what the Europeans said, this is what others said. In other words, make it easier if you need to do analysis on European constituents by simply filtering out everybody's not European, and you'd have a list there. And we do it by organisations that represent Europe, as well as organisations that are within Europe and within Australasia, and then within Australia, for example. So in the same with the US, we have groups that present a US view and others that, that are US companies. Or, you know, I don't know if that's helpful because I don't know whether you just rather receive reports. So,
Pat.
I had another question I'd like the group to think about, again, not necessarily with a view towards answering it today, but to think about it. One is an observation that Ian just made, which is something that we've heard a lot about, and that is the concept of change and change management. It's one thing to deal with an issue that's introduced in isolation. Let's say the only project that the ISB was undertaking today was the one dealing with revenue recognition. That's the only thing that, you know, you, for example, might have had to focus on as a outreach victim, if you will, somebody who's been engaged in the stakeholder process, and one in which you would be dealing with as a new standard. So change and the amount of change at any one point in time is something, my question is whether or not that is a cost that has to be dealt with, okay? Both the absolute amount of change. The second part of that is the complexity aspect of change. One of the other points that has been raised in a lot of our outreach is, well, it's one thing to propose a change in the recognition of right of use assets and lease liabilities on the balance sheet. It's another thing to propose a change that's going to require an extraordinary precise measurement of those assets and liabilities, i.e., let's take into consideration the embedded options in a lease agreement, the fact that some of them might involve variable lease payments, etc. So some people were very, you know, sanguine with recognizing these things. They acknowledge their liabilities. But let's not get overcome with or too precise in terms of how you go about measuring them. And obviously we have different opinions among the two boards on that very issue. Some people feel that these are absolutely essential if you're going to measure a liability correctly. You must take these features into consideration. So in the process of thinking about what we're measuring here in terms of cost, one of the things I think the group needs to advise us on is change, the amount of change we're proposing at any one point in time, a consideration, and the complexity of that change? Because I think some of us have different views on that topic, so it would be helpful for you to weigh in.
David.
Yes, I think I absolutely agree with that. The point I was going to make, Ian, I think, is that it's always worth us as standard setters thinking about making life easier for those that we're consulting. And certainly, you know, quite often when I read consultation papers, it takes quite a long time to work out what the central issues are. And I think it's worth, Alan, thinking when you're establishing a potential process, if you like, that at every stage, we should be very upfront. The ISB should be very upfront. Other regulators involved in projects should be upfront about what it is they want people to comment on. Certainly, thinking about almost all the people that we will consult, it's very unlikely, really, that it's one individual. It may be one individual who's preparing that organization or company's response, but actually, it's likely to be a response from a number of people within a particularly large company. And are we doing enough to make it straightforward for the individual pulling together the response across a large organization to respond? If you think of, I think of some of my stakeholders, some of the big oil companies, for example, you know, they might have several hundred people with an interest in a particular issue. Are we doing enough to communicate with that company sufficiently clearly? Is the material we're sending through in sufficiently standard form? It's something I think we should think about as we go through this process. You know, it isn't just us and them. The them in this case, the people we're consulting, are quite complicated organisations. They've got other pressures on them. Yeah. We need to make it easier for them.
I think that raises the question, unfortunately, too. Are we going to the right people in the first place?
Of course,
no,
yeah.
We just go to the accounting people? Are they the people that should be considering the province, or should it be somebody else? And should we just assume that the accounting people will go and talk to all the other people in their organisation, or are we going to get a sort of a biased response? It's an interesting question. I'm not sure I know the answer on how we fix it. Yeah. Pardon? Oh, sorry.
Going back to that question, I think that there is a cost for constant change in within the organization. I think that's quite clear. Also, complexity also carries a cost with it. So, turning back to my point earlier today, you think about better regulation and think that the way regulators generally tend to think, at least in Western Europe today, to think to keep down the regulatory burden. So this means that I think that priority, what you make a priority list, here you have very, very important financial reporting issues that need to be dealt with on an evidence base. You have to make a priority for that. And you say, there are so many things that we could improve, but we cannot put everything at the table at the same time, and you have to make priorities for that. I think that's an important lesson. So now the ISB is moving from convergence to doing its own work for the future. But I think you have to, in that sense, my personal belief is that financial reporting standard setting is not that different in this aspect from setting other rules or regulations. In that sense, it's nothing specific with this. And the thing is that all standard sets and regulators want to improve. That's what they're there for. It's quite obvious. But you have to make those priorities more clear. And complexity, that also goes back to that, you want to know the value of an offer. I would tell you what the value is, and then you think about if I got the value right or wrong. But if you think about coming out to stand and say, we have to make a decision, we should require that or not, or going for a proxy, that might be extremely important from that sense, from a preparer standpoint point of view. Also, adding to that, I think that it might be also some kind of issue of acceptance here. You think about companies accepting changes and accepting IFRS before directors, people running the company, explaining to them. This is also part of, the way that you convey your work, so to say. So I think there is a cost involved in this, that is not only the incremental cost of a specific change, but you have to think in an overall way.
Certainly our constituents were well aware of it when we put the agenda consultation out. You know, they're quite strong in their views. And I mean, the irony is, the first thing they said is finish off the full convergence program. But of course, in doing that, we're going to have huge change over the next 3 or 4 years, and we can't avoid it if we're going to finish those projects.
Can I add just one thing also? That one thing that you touched upon the leases project, which is also goes back to the way that companies work, is that the thing is about if information is already available within an accounting department or not in a company, or is there other kinds of information that you need to bring in? It's also going back to the complexity of it, because that will also trigger major changes. Of course, you try to require other types of information.
Yeah, and we always think about that, but you're never sure. I mean, sometimes you think it's so obvious that you couldn't run a company without this information, but then our constituents still tell us they haven't got it. You know, I mean, I don't know how they make their management judgments on a lot of things if we believe everything they tell us.
I have a question about something goes way back to something you talked about at the beginning about whether this is part of the technical development integrated process or separate. How is it best to convey it? Because we've had these big debates internally about whether the effect analysis should be a separate appendix, a separate publication, or built into the basis for conclusions. One of the problems with building into the basis for conclusions for us is that historically we've always expressed our basis for conclusions in the same order as the standard, so that people can read and see side by side why we did something. And that may not correlate at all with which issues are the most important parts of a standard. In fact, it almost certainly isn't going to correlate. Whereas we've thought about the effect analysis and more of our feedback statements, that tended to be an order of I won't say controversial, but where the biggest changes are going to be made, what the biggest effects are. And so it has focused on the big issues in Down. And if you're reading these things, you know, one of the problems is, if we integrated it fully into something like our, say, leases, we might end up with a 250 pages, yeah, more, 300 page document, and the effect analysis, I could say, would be subsumed or hidden in there, even though that's actually, it shows the context in which it was discussed. So the way we communicate this, and, you know, I suspect there's a trade-off between too long and too short. Too short means that you're a bit, didn't take it seriously enough.
Not granular.
Yeah. Too long means that it's too dense and impenetrable. So some feedback on that would be helpful.
Yes, so I'll start perhaps. And this is an issue we encountered as well.
Yeah.
And on communication, I would echo what other people have said. So simple, easy to read, and easy to understand also to a non-expert. That's the ideal type we also aim for. Not easy when you talk about complex issues, as in accounting, so I'm well aware of this. On length, the way we present it, it's usually a short report, 30 pages, highlighting the main issues, and then this is accompanied by annexes with more technical background. So this is one output. There is, at the moment, a shorter executive summary, 10 pages, and then a two-page extra short summary of all the key issues for people who have really limited time.
So you've got 2, 10, 30, and then
yes,
more.
Yes, but this, the last one was introduced only lately, and at the moment we are reviewing our guidelines. And it's easy, but not easy, it's still early to say what the outcome is going to be, but maybe one of them will be dropped. That's my personal guess. So this is on how to present things. And talking not always to the usual suspects, it's useful if we want to get different opinions. That's what we try to do.
I shouldn't laugh at you with the various pages. We put out another document called a snapshot when we're putting out a standard or an exposure draft. It's more than an effect analysis, it's a summary of the whole standard. But there is an audience for that. There's an audience that wants to read a few pages and get the gist of it. Sue?
We usually discuss this with our main advisory council, and we discovered it's really hard to get rid of anything you've ever provided in the past. And it's always easy to add things. Seriously, the one thing they commented that there was more than one audience and that the existing basis for conclusions is appropriate and necessary for a technical audience, particularly as they are implementing the standard, to understand what it means. So they liked the detail and wanted us to keep that. But they said that as with all that detail, it's very difficult for the average person to see the forest for the trees. And they did support the idea of providing an executive summary, something that would be much shorter, that would explain to a non-technical audience what we saw as being the main benefits, what we saw as being the principal costs, and why the board concluded those benefits justify the costs. And the technical audience, more so than the user audience, was also very interested in that analysis, explaining all the steps that we took and the procedures we performed and the balance of who we spoke with. They just thought that was necessary context to understand the conclusions. So unfortunately, you know, I shouldn't say unfortunately, but I think given the number of different audiences you have, it's just not possible to have one document that's going to meet all the needs of your varying stakeholders.
We had a meeting last week with the Russian constituents and the ex-Russian states, and one fellow there had a very nice saying. He's talking about disclosures and how things get hidden, and he said, if you want to hide a leaf, the best place is in a forest. I think it's not bad. Tomasa.
I agree. I think there might be an executive summary that it's available, accessible for also non-technicians. And on where, I think that there should be a separate document and not within the basis for conclusion, because I think that it should be accessible to everybody. Why is the basis for conclusion accessible only to people that access to the standards? And in basis for conclusion, I would see the reference to the separate document in which we explain why we have taken some decision in respect of the effect analysis.
Okay.
So, ask Paul, if you're doing assessment for Sir Dodd-Frank, is there any particular, again, is this separated out so you have, you know, I guess, targeted reports for particular issues?
In each rulemaking, there's a separate section where they go through and go through the effects analysis. They will, in that analysis, break out specific issues if they're relevant to particular parties. And so if they're putting in an audit requirement, they'll talk about the impact on auditor and auditor behavior as opposed to some of the more general impacts that might be related to the preparer. But in each of the documents, there is a separate section that deals with whether you want to call it cost benefit or effects analysis. It's sort of the same issue.
Okay. Yeah, one of the advantages that we found, I think, of incorporating it with the basis, in a sense, it has a separate section though, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The leases, is that we have been criticized that the board was not looking or signing off on the effect analysis. So by including that in the one document, it became part of our ballot process. And so people can see very clearly that our board are actually signing off at the same time. Historically, we were producing the effect analysis after we, you know, the order would be we'd ballot the document, then we'd do the effect analysis in a sort of an easy-to-read format. But some criticised us for making it look more like a marketing document, if anything, and again, not balloted. So So we had this debated internally, I think even for leases, whether it should be a section of the basis for conclusions or whether it should be an appendix to the basis for conclusions. Because we're still considering whether or not when we produce our big volumes, where we have our bound volumes have the standards and then at the back the basis, whether we should just not put the effect analysis in there because we don't consider that to be part of the actual explanation for the standard. That's more of a rationale for some of the decision making in terms of cost benefit, for example. Otherwise, there is a risk our bound volume is going to be very extensive because you know we don't put our feedback statements in there either. Peter,
I think your mentioning of the bound volume is an important point because if you include the effect analysis in the final standard, then presumably it will be part of copyrighted material that only subscribers have access to, and perhaps certain constituents do want to have that material. Also, I think the point that Claudio raised about the need to describe the methodology you applied is quite valid. So again, that would add to the bulk of the document, and it's probably not an issue if it's published separately. But, to understand it might not work in the longer run. Also because I suspect in the future you may have situations where the two documents are not completed on exactly the same timeline.
I mean, it could be that we could keep it within for the exposure draft and make it separate for the final standard or something. The advantage with the exposure draft is then we can ask questions on the effect analysis and whatnot at the same time. That's another way of thinking of it.
Okay. Confidential information. We've skirted a bit around. We have an issue when we go off and speak to 25 investors, and we hear things, we summarise that, and we convey the fact that we spoke to 25 investors, and then people invariably ask, well, who? Because I spoke to three investors and got a different answer, and or heard different things. So what should we do? Because we have struggled with this. Our due process oversight committee's made the same point, and we've been discussing with them how we can convey this. because we try to put on our website what sort of outreach we do, who's involved, but it can be quite difficult other than describing, you know, that we spoke to representatives from three investment banks, two based in Europe, one based in the UK, and two in the US or something like that. It's five. What do we do? Because presumably you need confidence that we've actually spoken to the right, well, not the right people, but representatives, group of people.
The trade-off in some cases is we don't get to speak to them at all unless...
It's better, to talk to people and give them the option of remaining anonymous. Accepting that if they do remain anonymous, that their points may carry less force than those who... I think that's just integral part of the process. You can't cut people off from consultation if they're not prepared to be named. I think that's just not... doesn't work, does it?
Yeah. The way we've described it to our due process oversight committee is it's a bit like giving evidence in a court about somebody is in the stand and giving evidence as opposed to circumstantial evidence, and that you just have to be very careful about the way you weight that evidence. And perhaps there are two other things that can protect us a bit. One is in the exposure draft itself, if we are asking more targeted questions around the likely effects or the likely costs and so on, then we will get direct feedback on those very issues, and that becomes a much clearer, a better substitute in a way than talking anonymously with people, because people are committing to pen in public some feedback. And the second thing is use a variety of techniques, and that I was thought if you have comment letters and then you do a brief survey, for example, and you get consistent messages, it gives you more comfort that you've actually got different types of evidence are consistent with each other. And if they're not, then you have to think about digging a bit deeper in one way or the other.
Buddha.
In terms of confidentiality, I mean, we provide confidentiality to people who participate in our field test, but it does have a number of drawbacks. I think the first one is that our studies are a bit less convincing if I have to say, well, it's all based on anonymous sources and I'm not going to tell you who, because everybody will always wonder, well, did he talk to his friends and family or were there serious parties? So effectively the information that you collect is less useful because you can do less with it. Also, I think if you promise full confidentiality in off-the-record conversations, people are more likely to make somewhat outrageous claims, whereas if it's situation where somebody may want to verify the information, they have a slightly more balanced, better position that's better thought through. So I think that's also important. I think in general, it's probably wise to have a policy of sorts, data protection and confidentiality policy, to say, well, this is what we can promise and this is something we won't promise, because if everybody wants to be completely anonymous, you end up with an enormous amount of work and not that much stuff that you can share or use to convince your constituents that this is a good idea. So I think there must be some limits to the confidentiality, how far you're willing to go. And if that means you don't get a response from a certain person, well, perhaps a trade-off.
I might be wrong, Alan, but I don't think it's a huge problem for us, is it? I mean, the vast majority of our consultation is quite public, and the people are happy to be named and often put it in writing, be able to be put on the record. But we do have some circumstances where people, either because they're giving away commercial and confidence information or whatever other reason, especially want to do field testing and things like that. And so I think, as David said, you've got to make a judgment call. You've got to realise that evidence is not as good as evidence that's open and transparent. But it's maybe better than not having the evidence, you know.
I mean, if I can use an example on revenue recognition, if you want to test the revenue recognition policies and one of your participants is a defence contractor, they may not want to discuss the exact issues in the public forum. On the other hand, you don't need to anonymize it to the point where it's useless to everybody.
So, I mean, I think it boils down to a lot of things, a bit of common sense.
Yeah. the more information about the demographics is probably helpful.
Yeah.
Get a sense of who, at least which areas we went to and the types of people.
It's a large company in the UK beginning with D or something.
Yeah. Sells weapons in the UK.